Lieutenant Mamiya, in a letter to Toru Okada, from the novel The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Hiroki Murakami. What I hope to find is the meaning of the life that I have lost. By what was it taken away from me, and why? I want to know the answers to these questions with absolute certainty. And I would go so far as to say that if I could have those answers, I would not mind being even more profoundly lost than I already am. Solve the World, a fictional adventure told in 100 episodes. Episode 81, Wedding Bells. Jennifer Dash looks stunning in her long dress. She stares at Atticus from across the aisle. His eyes are filling with tears of excitement, nervousness, and, at long last, happiness. Beside Jen, to her right, stands Betty. She tries her best in the quaint church to beam out a broad, warm smile. Jen knows better. Betty's hurting inside. It's understandable. She loved Atticus too. Scout Further, who looks all grown up, is happy for her brother, but she too is losing something today. Jen tries not to take her eyes off of Atticus. He cleans up nice, that one. His eyes aren't on Jen. They're stuck on his bride. Marching up the middle aisle in all white, Betsy. Not Betty. Not Jennifer. Betsy. Betsy Morrow. About to be Betsy Further. It's been 1 year since the horrors of Onmo, and Atticus Further is marrying local girl Betsy Morrow. It happened quickly, yet this moment was predictable enough. After living through hell, people look for security. They want to find a grip on happiness and wrestle that feeling into submission for the rest of their lives. When they returned to Louisiana, Atticus tried to take back up with Betty. She was still diligently holding down the fort, hoping beyond hope. But her composure didn't fit with Atticus's anymore. Betty started out as a common-sense country girl. Now she was a get-her-done, no-fancy-business pragmatist, through and through. That didn't fit Atticus's temperament. He found a light out of his own personal darkness by writing down all his thoughts, his feelings. Now back home in Louisiana, Atticus became a certifiable blogger. The thing about his writings that made them somewhat unique is that all his entries were short, staccato fragments. Just reading them without knowing the context of young Mr. Further's life and adventures, you really couldn't make any sense out of the words on the screen. Every post was a puzzle piece that would never fit with the whole. Since there was no story to follow, the allure of Atticus's scribblings was not the plot, but the emotion. Every single idea he wrote started and ended with his reactions to his own feelings. It was therapy, self-help. That's all fine and dandy, and if that's what Atticus needs to live with himself, then God bless his soul. But Betty didn't live in that world. Life had pushed her to live hand-to-mouth. She was a survivor, by choice. Every time Betty sat down to read Atticus's mind unspooled, it felt like he was a survivor by accident. By lady luck, by the wheel of fortune, by fate, maybe by destiny. But it wasn't because of himself. It wasn't because of any sort of courageous will to triumph. On this condition, Betty found it harder and harder to connect to Atticus on any sort of personal or intimate level. There was disconnect, and it grew and grew with each passing week. 2 months into Atticus and Scout's return, and Betty knew she had to move out. She chose then to move in with Jen. As for Betty and Jen, they lived together in a two-bedroom apartment in Shreveport for just short of 6 months. As it happened, Jen and Betty were much closer to soulmates than Atticus ever was to either of them. Jen's daredevil tactic to retrieve beef for Betty spoke volumes about the character of Jennifer Dash. Beyond that, Jen's ability to endure, despite half the world hunting her, only made the teenager appear to Betty like a wise old sage. Betty wanted what Jen had, or at least one of those character traits to rub off on her. Even so, even knowing that Atticus and Betty should never be together, Betty still coveted him in her heart. She held on to this deep conviction, hoping beyond hope, that he'd toughen up, learn to adapt more properly for the current age. He had to mature. Betty knew this much. But hopefully, after the maturation process took its effect, he'd come back to her, and they'd be the ones that ended up married. She loved him, after all. How many nights did Betty imagine Atticus knocking at their door in Shreveport? Repented? Wizened, finally? That's how you get the girl, at least in Betty's mind. Of course, life doesn't work like that. 9 times out of 10. But Betty held out hope she'd be that one time. That everything could be lovely for us all. She and Jen would stay up, maybe once a week, talking boys, and hoping for futures that'd probably never appear. Thank God Jen came. Without her here, Betty wouldn't have had the courage to show up to the wedding, let alone be a bridesmaid. Betsy, Atticus's new bride, had 3 brothers that she just had to have in her wedding. So, Atticus had the 3 brothers as his groomsmen, and Betsy took on the 3 women closest to Atticus. He was so oblivious. All these girls, each connected to him. He, unknowingly shrugging them off. Scout felt that. If it wasn't for his breakdown, she'd never have been taken up by Anmo. Worse still, had Jen not pushed him, pretty much forced him, he'd never had searched Scout out in the Great White North. She would have died up there like so many of her peers, gutted for a door sacrificed by some unknown demon. Do you, Betsy Morrow, take Atticus further to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to love Atticus, comfort him, honor and keep him for better or for worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, be faithful only to him so long as you both shall live?
I do.
Do you, Atticus Further, take Betsy Morrow to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to love Betsy, comfort her, honor and keep her, for better or for worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, 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 and forsaking all others? Atticus shoots a glance at Jen when the pastor says, forsaking all others. Jen wondered, was Atticus taking this marriage as a vow of rebellion? Was he forsaking the world and his supposed destiny? Be faithful only to her so long as you both shall live. I do. Then, by the power invested in me by the great state of Louisiana, you may kiss the bride. Nates' story. A group of people meet every Thursday night at a certain community center. One particular evening, a young, broken man named Nates had the spotlight on him. His story is as follows. Thank you. grow up happy. At least, for a while. You, your little sister, your mother, your father. When you're old enough, you realize that what you have is rare. Most families aren't happy. Most people don't like spending time with each other. You'd play games. Your sister played handball. Mom, Dad, and you acted like her games were World Cup tournaments. You'd all scream, holler, yell at the parents from the other team. It was great. You, your family, were a team. At some point, you can't remember exactly when it started, Dad began changing. He was grumpy, all the time. Not mean, not even enough for you to say anything. Just irritable, quick to the trigger. He works in insurance, part of the sales team, but he's not a salesman per se. His work revolves around retention, getting people to stay in the boat. That was the way he always described it. Gotta keep people in the boat, he'd say. He'd say it so much, you and Mom would get in the habit of asking him, anyone jump ship today? You didn't think about it then, but now that you're older, you wonder about that. He'd come home from a long day at work, or a week if he happened to be traveling, which he did often. He walks in the door and the first thing you ask him is, hey, Dad, anyone jump ship today? That's such a negative question. It's like saying, did you suck at your job today, Father? He was always a good sport about it, though. You have memories of him chuckling, responding usually with something like, they're not just staying in the boat, they're rowing the whole damn thing. You don't really understand what that means, but you catch the playfulness in his tone and laugh with him. After all, if they're in the boat, that's all that matters, right? But he's irritable. He's drinking when he comes home. Mom starts prying, trying to ask what's wrong. He says he can't sleep. That's the only answer you and Mom ever get. Can't sleep, he always says. You believe him because it shows. His eyelids sag, the rings around them are growing whiter and darker every day. His flesh is a pasty white with darkening blue tint circles spreading on his cheeks. He's losing weight. 15, 20 pounds. One day he goes on a trip. For work, he says. But it bothers you. Feels like a lie. His insurance work had plenty of travel involved, but it was always pre-planned. You have a family calendar tapped to the refrigerator. Everyone adds to it. Your sister's handball games, for instance. Whose week it is to do the laundry. You would always write down the days that your favorite movies were coming to the Cineplex. This trip wasn't on the calendar. He told you in the morning he was leaving, then was gone a week. It kept happening. Just like that. At first it was happening maybe once every couple of months, but it started becoming more frequent every month. Then quick 4, even 3-day trips. Always without any notice. Dad's story was paper thin. Clients, he'd always say. Gotta go see the clients. On further interrogation, he'd add something like, the office has a new policy that I have to go out and physically meet with every problem client. You may be young, but you're not dumb. You know what this is. You've watched enough TV, read enough Reddit posts, known enough friends who have similar family stories. Father is having an affair. That's the only explanation. Nothing else fits. Your suspicions are confirmed. You come home from school one day to find your mother sobbing, throwing clothes at your dad. He's blank-faced. She's in hysterics. The big revelation of the day was that you're broke. Dad had been siphoning off every last cent of the family's security blanket. Mom had gone to the store to buy groceries that afternoon. Her credit card was declined. Your family is broke. Beyond broke, actually. Dad had maxed out all lines of credit. His business trips to see clients apparently weren't paid by his work. Here's what happens next. Mom and Dad drive together away from the house. They say they have to talk these things through away from us kids. They, quote, didn't want to bother you, they say. You have homework to do anyway, son. You and your sis get nothing done that evening. You snuggle up with her, pop some popcorn, and watch Bruce Willis save the world in Armageddon. This, of course, is several years before the plague and the bombs. Armageddons were still light escapism back then. When they return, you notice immediately Mom and Dad are holding hands, smiling even. You don't get it. Dad pulls a chair up next to the couch. He leans in. You hold your breath. You're old enough to know that moments like these are life-defining. Here it comes. Dad says he's been laid off. He didn't want to tell us, and apparently there was some business deal that he's been trying to work out in the country of Belize, Central America. A business deal, he says, that's worth all the marbles. You don't know what that means. Whose marbles? What do the marbles stand for? Money? You don't say much. You don't question Dad because you want your sister to feel comfortable. You don't want your doubt to rub off on her. She's had enough fear for one day. You still can't wrap your mind around the fact that your mother acted like a blithering idiot earlier in the day, but now she seems as calm as a dove. Why is everyone peaceful? Did Dad fully explain this Belize deal to Mom? Why wasn't he giving us more details? The questions remain. We sell the house. Move into a flat of a family friend. Just for a while, Mom and Dad say. Just for a while. Things are okay. But not for long. By the end of the week, Dad's leaving again for Belize. He's gone for 3 weeks. When he comes back, he only stays 3 days. Then he's gone again. After that trip, Mom and Dad take that car ride again. You watch the day after tomorrow with the sis this time. When you hear them drive up, you know in your heart. Something's different. This time, there's nowhere else to fall together. Falling together can't keep happening. The only thing left to do is fall apart. Instead of pulling up a chair, Dad asks you to take a walk with him. You oblige. This is how it happens. Divide and conquer. Mom with your sister, Dad with you. This is how we fall apart. On the walk, he tells you everything. The truth, this time. There was never any business deal in Belize. But there was also never any woman. At least, not in the conventional sense. He couldn't sleep, he tells you. Behind his eyelids, death was hunting him. Those are his words. He'd lay in bed completely empty, dreaming of sleep, but the Sandman would never come. Apparently, he tried everything. Counseling, pills, drugs. You name it, he tried it. But sleep would never come. He'd asked the doctor why he wasn't dead. That it'd been literally months he'd gone without sleep. He thought you had to get some sleep or eventually you'd die. The doctor said that he was in fact sleeping in microbursts, 1 to 5 seconds at a time. Supposedly, this was enough to keep him going on in perpetuity. Dad wouldn't believe it. He felt death's presence. Already, he was the walking dead. Then, your dad tells you, it all changes. He was sent to Belize by his work, just one time. It was some kind of insurance conference retreat in Central America. They do ropes course training in the rainforest. Look at monkeys. Lots of cool stuff. Then, one day they had the day off. One day in Belize. Most people took a ferry out to Belize's Caribbean islands. Drink rum on the sandy beach in a coconut. Maybe go snorkeling in the clear blue shallows. Chow down on lobster caught that morning. Dad felt a different calling. He tells you Mother Earth called him. Called him to the fresh water. Called him to the caves. That day you took a 7-hour cave tubing tour. Jumped into an inner tube and floated down a slow-moving river that weaved in and out of a system of caves. All the tubers were given headlamps. Common people used the lamps to scope out the cave walls, the stalactites and stalagmites. Not Father. He floated. And he slept. 7 hours. When it was over, he said he was a new man. Fully rested for the first time in months and months. There was something about the caves. Something about that place that gave him an inner peace unlike anything else. Portions of the cave are pitch black if you have your headlamp turned off. Dad thought maybe that was the cause, so he found a cave here, locally, just a couple kilometers away. Tried to sleep in it. Didn't take. Nothing. Only in the bowels of the abandoned Mayan heritage caves could Dad get some honest-to-goodness rest. Only there. Desperate, he went back. Every time, it works. He can sleep there. Only there. He drifts, he floats, he closes his eyes. You wonder, is there something to this? Is there something in those caves? You're 14 years old. You can sleep fine. You don't need the caves. But here, your father is telling you that in order to live, he has to move to Belize. He invited your mom to move with him. She refuses. So, there's going to be a divorce. He leaves. He says it's the only thing for him now. It's been 15 years. You've never visited. He's never come back. You talk on the phone, sure. Text once in a while. He can't come back. You understand that. Really, you do. He's addicted. He can't be that far away from his rest. He goes every night. A 4-hour float. He knows all the locals. 4 hours a night in there is all he needs. Says he sleeps like a baby. 4 hours. You wish you could get by on 4 hours of sleep. Just think of all the extra things you could do with your life. So much. But here's the thing. A little over a month ago, you stopped being able to sleep. Insomnia hits you. Bad. You can't sleep anymore. It's like a shadow. You could never catch up on it. You can't sleep. You can't sleep. And all you can think about is if those caves hold the answer. Sure, it might be psychosomatic. It might be all in his head. There's probably nothing special inside those stone walls. There can't be any magic in those flowing streams. Yet you lie in bed. 4 a.m. Wondering. What if? Why don't you go? Why don't you try it out? Because what if it's real? What would that mean? That's an answer you can't handle. You'll just have to keep going. Sleepless, and, at least for now, still in control of your own fate. Then, by the power invested in me by the great state of Louisiana, you may kiss the bride. Dancing. Jen and Betty stood with their backs on the rails of the wall in a large barnyard adjacent to the church. You okay? Jen asked. Yeah. You? Of course, Jen replied. How's Europe? I really like it, Jen said, almost solemnly. Making any friends? A few. How about you? Getting by in Shreveport? Yeah. Lights faded, the DJ blathered, and Scout took the dance floor with her big brother. Betsy, meanwhile, took part and parcel with her eldest brother.
Come on, we can make it happen. If it takes all night, we can sleep it all off tomorrow. Come on, keep it.
This sibling slow dance took the place of the father of the bride, mother of the groom dance. Both Atticus and Betsy's parents were dead. With this match, they'd be orphans no more. Can I ask you a question? Betty said uneasily to Jen. Shoot, do you think any of our decisions matter? How do you mean? Well, I'm watching Atticus, and you know how I feel about him. I know that it was never going to be a good fit with him. You know that. Okay. Jen said, unsure of where Betty was going. But I can't help thinking, if there's no point to our lives, if we just exist and then we die, why aren't I with him? Because he wouldn't be happy, Betty. Sure, eventually. But I'd be happy today, wouldn't I? We can't live like that. Why not? Jen let the question sit there, hovering above the dumb wedding mixtape, floating like an evil specter above everyone.
Alright, now it's time for the money dance! Grab your purses and help these two lovebirds out!
It wasn't a big reception, maybe 50 people, but just about everyone got in line. You gonna get in line? Jen asked Betty. Why? What would be the point in that? Jen shrugged and moseyed on over. She'd come all this way, got all dressed up. She might as well get in the line, right? Jen, now going by the name Jenna, walked at the back of the line. She wasn't dead last when she got in line to dance with the now-married Atticus Further, but for some reason she felt obliged to let the two old ladies behind her surpass her in the queue. There was something about things like this in the new, normalizing post-apocalypse world that brought out not only the best in people, but the most generous. Weddings were important not just to the newlyweds, but for the whole community. It represented a certain continuity. The old, nostalgic world still had veins reaching into this new era. The plague had died. People had abandoned their loved ones, refused to touch the damned. In return, the plague had puckered out. Sure, there were still thousands of weird societies cropping up, new theories abounding here and there and everywhere. Cults, clubs, what have you. But the common person just wanted things to be calm, be normal. So, despite the manifold nuclear blasts, despite all the death, anger, and evil, tiredness won the day. Governments, somehow, didn't collapse. Not by any virtue, but, in most cases, by root memory. Take, for instance, Louisiana. There was no standing governor. The last had died 6 months ago. Senators, likewise, were dead. Similarly, most of the state's Senate were deceased or in eternal hiding. But one day, one unsinkable mayor made up a ballot. He put all his friends on it, for governor, senator, whoever. And then he drove around the state passing out the ballots. A month later, the ballots were collected by the mayor and his friends. They personally tallied the results and elected a new governor. Nobody resisted. Everyone accepted the outcome. After all, there had been an election, there had been winners and losers. That's how it always had been done. That's how life was supposed to go. And so Louisiana rose from the ashes. People went back to work. For this reason, and many others, everyone at the reception felt inclined to give to the money dance. They did so with joy in their hearts. There would be another generation. That was good. And these good Samaritans of the community were making sure this new couple had the financial stability to ring in the next generation with love and stability. Finally, at the front of the line. Hello. Hello, Jenna. Hello, Mr. Further. Can I take this dance? But of course. Gracefully, Jen slipped $40 into Atticus's pocket. She was doing fine financially these days. Parting with a few bucks was no big deal. Her job in Slovenia paid well enough. She wasn't a big spender, so most of the revenue she brought in just sat in a bank. Thank you so much for coming, Atticus said, two arms around Jen's waist. I think you win the prize for traveling the farthest in coming here. You think? There was no doubt that Jen had come the farthest. The rest of this happy mob were all clearly Louisianans, born and bred. Well, I'm not sure where he came from. Atticus motioned with a nod towards Betsy and the man she was dancing with. Jen did a comical double take. It couldn't be. It couldn't be. But it was. Dressed in an all-black, three-piece tuxedo, looking to Jen like a Dread Pirate Roberts, sporting black gloves, was Miles Fong. How Jen trailed off. Did you invite him? Sure didn't. Jen wanted to hate Miles. Maybe she did. Usually, choosing to hate him came naturally. But the mystery man was a paradox. After the end went down, it was Miles that took them to safety. It was Miles that got Jen her nose job to conceal her identity. He got her the impeccable fake ID, full with a driver's license, passport, social security card, even a birth certificate. She was now, in the eyes of the law, Jenna Finn. He'd done all that right when they got back to Louisiana. Then, Miles vanished. He said that he was on a mission to find the Shining Man. After playing for the other side so long, he had to see the darkness for himself. And that was that. Since then, radio silence. Until now.
All right, boys and girls, let's gather up over to your left. Right, room, come on up because it's time to cut the cake!
Jen couldn't believe it. She rubbed her eyes like a cartoon figure. Surely she was seeing things. She floated to the dark night.
Well, it was midnight on the sea. The band played near my dog's knee. Fairly Titanic, fairly well. Yes, it was midnight on the sea. The band played near my dog's knee. Fairly Titanic, fairly well.
Miles, Jen said to Miles' backside. He turned. Jen had to catch herself, her astonishment so revolting. From across the dance floor, he looked his usual suave self. But up close, she could see he had changed. He had aged horribly.
And it was midnight on the sea. The band played near my love.
Ah, Miss Finn, Jen said. Yes, that's right. Miss Finn. Would you mind speaking to me outside? I have a proposition for you. Proposition. A proposition. Proposition. What sort of proposition? Jen thought.
When Jack Johnson heard about the shark, he went and danced the Eagle Rock. Fairly Titanic, fairly well. When the wind two got on land, crying, Lord, have mercy on my man. So it was midnight on the sea. The band played near my dog's knee. Fairly Titanic, fairly well. Yes, it was midnight on the sea. The band played near my dog's knee. Fairly Titanic, fairly well.
Good to be back. No, this is Dante Stack, creator of Solve the World, and I want to thank you for returning to Solve the World now that we're starting part four, the final 20 episodes of The Epic of Jennifer Dash. By the way, as always, all music and sound effects were found under Creative Commons licenses and are appropriately attributed on our show notes page at DanteStack.com. Bye.